Welcome back to the podcast. We're gonna try to keep this one tight and short and not 2 hours long. I'm Nathaniel Rogers with a film experience, and I'm here with Katie Rich from Cinema Blend,
Hello.
Joe Reed from Low Resolution and other sundry places.
Hello. Wow. No, that's about right. That's an accurate description.
Okay, and Nick Davis from Nick's Flick Picks.
I'm keeping it so tight tonight.
You kept it tight.
I'm keeping it tight.
So I just got back from Lincoln, actually.
Oh, wow.
And
Ooh.
yeah.
Clothed in immense power.
I've been so doubting, just people's like, oh, it's gonna win this, and it was really good.
I'm with you.
It was funny because right after the screening, the people next to me, not the people I was with, but just, the adjacent crowd started
Jason.
they were like, did you even see Daniel Day-Lewis? I didn't. He vanished. And I was waiting for you guys. I was like, someone's gonna say he is Lincoln.
He is
But
Lincoln.
sadly, they did not. They just said he vanished into the role.
That's basically the same thing, yeah.
Yeah.
I
That
never
someone will
saw him,
say
and I looked for him. That's what they said.
I looked for
I was
His
like,
name was in the credits and everything. Where
I
was
know.
he?
That was like my favorite story from last Oscar season when Bette Midler was like, I watched my good friend Glenn Close's movie Albert Nobbs, and I called her at the end because I didn't understand because she wasn't in it. And then she told me she was Albert, and I couldn't believe it. This is the lamest story in the
I love that kind of like stick to it Hollywood hamminess though, where it's just like, you know what, she's got a
Totally.
bit. She's got a bit, and she is going to sell it to the very last. Like, good for her.
Yeah.
If only Glenn Close had gone that big. But we're talking about Lincoln.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I was just all impressed all around. And I have to say this about Tony Kushner. I don't understand why I was dreading, like, the typical biopic. My favorite thing about his work in general is he can drill home every time that politics is personal.
Yeah.
He's so good at, like, contextualizing it into what lives are actually like. I don't know. I was very impressed with it.
So you're a fan of the movie overall, kind of top to bottom?
I am, except for, as is my problem with Spielberg, the beginning and the ending.
Ah. Oh, that scene on the with Dane DeHaan and somebody
Yeah,
else, some other recognizable
I thought
face.
that was very
Lucas
awkward.
Haas. It was very Lucas Haas.
Lucas Haas, that's right. Yeah.
Yes. The beginning and the ending, it's always my thing with Spielberg. It just always feels like a little like he's just, I'm like, but the rest is so good. Do you have to like push it that way? I don't know.
A friend of mine was talking to me yesterday about the ending, about how he wasn't satisfied with the ending. And I am probably less bullish on the movie than most people are right now anyway. But I thought the end, I didn't think the ending felt as draggy as I'm hearing some people describe.
I had less of a problem with the dragginess than just the way, I mean, the way they deal with, spoiler alert, the assassination,
What?
which I know.
What the
I'm
fuck,
so sorry, you
Katie?
guys. I'm so sorry, you guys. It was necessary. Just the way that whole thing is handled, it felt very like super Spielberg, whereas the rest of the movie feels more restrained Spielberg. I mean, you guys know the shot I'm talking about. We don't have to go into detail for people
Yes.
who haven't seen it.
Are we the hallway or the
The
hallway?
kid. The kid.
Yeah,
the kid.
The
Uh-huh.
hallway
Yep.
too, but the kid especially.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't even think it needed. I would have been happy enough had it ended in the carriage. But anyway.
Which is how Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter ends, which I feel is necessary to point out. It ends with them on their way to Ford Theater.
For as much as, you know, I respect the rigorousness of the script and how it's very admirably wonky, I believe, in terms of just like the politics of it.
Yeah.
But I don't think I would have ever expected it to be that sort of self-consciously arty at the end, to just be like, you know, and then they went off in the carriage to Ford's Theater. Who knows what might have happened? Like, I think there are certain
Choose your own
expectations.
adventure.
Yeah, right.
I actually, if you believe he falls into quicksand, I thought the actual last shot was cool. Well, I guess we still won't say, but like the actual last impression, which is kind of, modest in a way, but
Yeah.
totally to the point, I liked. But I agree that like the 5 minutes or so that preceded that were not my favorite.
Well, and this
but
is
I was so super into it.
I mean, I knew the movie was working for me, that I did not want to hurl the every time James Spader was on screen.
I thought he vanished.
I didn't know that. I didn't recognize him at all. Like, when his name came up in the credits, I was totally taken aback.
I mean, it was one of these movies, actually, where the entire supporting cast being famous people did not actually pull me out of it.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
The fact
thing.
That I recognized every face did not bother me at all, and I think that was because the movie was so good about contextualizing, like, you know, it wasn't just a period piece, it was just, like, these, you know, politics affects our lives, you know, and it was okay that it was everybody I recognized, because for me, I saw Daniel Day-Lewis. He did not vanish. I know. I saw where he was in every frame. I was like, that's Daniel Day-Lewis!
There's light falling on him and everything.
It was like a garden of earthly delights. Like, every time you thought you had had all the fun candy, they'd be like, no, a Patha Merkerson.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, see, but okay. It started to feel a little bit comedic to me, I think, at some point when they... And I can't remember exactly when. It might have been Jackie Earle Haley. It might have been... But I think by the time you get to Essa Patha Merkerson, and...
I love saying that name, don't you?
I know. She's and she's fantastic, and I love her. And not only the reveal of her... But the reveal of, like...
What's going that, on?
Her role in the movie.
And just the fact that we get that sort of, like, Cosby Show 2 shot of, like, Flip and Claire in bed at the end of the day talking about, like, what happened. Really, really hokey. And I sort of...
Yeah.
The expectation that I'm not supposed to giggle at that seemed to stretch credulity to me. And I'm like, I don't think they're quite nailing what they're going for. That.
But on the other hand, one of the saving graces of the movie is its sense of humor.
Yes, when it's I just don't
when it's intentionally funny.
Yes, exactly. That's
And like the
I don't think that was an intentionally sober moment. Especially,
I don't think it was supposed to make you laugh at it.
No, no.
I'm much more with Joe in terms of the skepticism, and I feel like the relevant question to this is: you guys, Nick and Nathaniel, you guys were both down with Sally Field, huh?
I didn't mind her.
I
thought she
her.
Was okay.
I'm finding myself in the minority, having been driven crazy by her. So I guess I have to just kind of accept this, that everyone else liked her in it.
I mean, for me, I can't go out on a limb. The true standout is Tommy Lee Jones, 100%.
Yeah.
Which is what everyone seems to think, so.
Yeah, I'm happy to stand by my call on that. Sally Field, if I could just keep thinking about that scene with her and Tommy Lee Jones, where she's just sort of like, my husband is very popular with the people. Like, that was a fantastic scene, and I absolutely loved her in that. And if I think of that and not anything else, I'm totally good. Yeah. It's when I start thinking of her sort of in the drawing room, on her knees, kind of like, sort of malining out about, you know, her dead son or whatever. Like... That's
See,
me.
I like
your verb.
Malining. To malin.
Well, you knew exactly what I meant when I said it. So.
I did.
But that implies that you do not appreciate malin, which is a problem.
Malin works in context.
Exactly. Malin did not need to be in Lincoln.
Well, maybe Mary Todd Lincoln was the OG original Steel Magnolia. Maybe you haven't thought
That's true. I didn't think this through.
I have to say, like, that scene that you guys are referring to was one of my favorite parts of the movie.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh.
I've been hearing that from quite a few people. I just feel
And like... I especially love the follow-up, the switch in her behavior when she's, like, sort of accepted his ultimatum, and then she throws out one last jab while they're in the theater. I love that scene.
Oh.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That was a little bit, like... I didn't always love the writing of her character, which in that moment was one, and the early premonition about the dream was one, although that felt very Kushner to me, all the sort of premonitions and, you know, whatever. But I feel like she's sort of Helena Bonham Carter in The King's Speech to me. Like, you know, I won't think it makes sense if she gets nominated. She's the lady in the movie. That might be enough. But I liked her. I liked her. I liked everybody. But you know, especially Day-Lewis. I thought he was great.
Yeah.
Wait, he was in the movie?
In the cut I saw, he made appearances.
So you guys are feeling like crazy Best Picture frontrunner on this?
No. I just really enjoyed it.
Okay.
I think...
Mary Todd Lincoln knows.
You know what, though? You guys have got me turned around on at least, like, predicting it, because I wasn't expecting it to get as good reviews as it's gotten, and it's gotten, like, the best reviews.
Yeah, same here.
Well, and I'm famously a Spielberg holdout, so if I'm even on board, then, you know.
So, and now, because I had been thinking up until then, like, everything seems just so fatally flawed except for Argo, and I figured it was just going to be Argo by default. And then, but now I'm thinking, okay, well, now this is a two-horse race. This is Argo and Lincoln, and there are other things that could sort of jump up to their level, but I think that's the level right now, is those two.
Right. I mean, I think that I feel like the same qualms that we're all expressing about how excited or not excited we were about seeing it will continue to accrue to it through the award season. Like, I don't know that it's the first thing everybody's going to want to watch, and it's not quite as exciting to vote for Spielberg or the Yankees or Microsoft as it is to vote for something else. But I think if they can play the angle of, like, sometimes a reelected beloved president has to find a way to work with Congress, like, that's amazing.
That's incredible.
And it's an angle that it's nicer to think about than, let's think about going to war with Iran and the last time we were thinking about that. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, it's much more positive to think about the similarities of Lincoln.
Oh, with Argo, you're talking
with
about.
With Argo, yeah.
Like, seeing Lincoln at the New York Film Festival, a month ago, like, the whole re-election, you know, president trying to work with Congress, it didn't occur to me. Like, none of those parallels were in my brain at all.
Because nobody wanted to think about the election at all because we were so blasted with election fatigue.
Exactly. And now that it's over, I think people are, I mean, they're automatically going to think of it. Of course they are.
Right.
So there's that whole resonance that's there that I wasn't even imagining until, you know, a week ago.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And does make it seem like Tony Kushner might be a seer.
Okay, so one more thing on Lincoln before we move on, but can we get a shout out to the hair and makeup department?
Oh, yes! so many wigs.
Well, and not just so many wigs, but so well done.
Yeah,
like it didn't feel Hollywood to me. It felt like, I don't know, I just thought the makeup was terrific.
You didn't see it.
Yeah,
you didn't see the makeup. It was there.
I
didn't see a single wig.
it vanished.
and when you did see a wig, it was purposefully, you were supposed to see it, as in Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah, that was a reveal that I thought was really good. I might just go back and watch all the Tommy Lee Jones scenes again. I think they work best in the context of, like, things are getting a little, you know, politically dense. Like, need somebody to cut through the bureaucracy a little bit, and he just sort of slices right through it.
All the scenes on the House floor, I would happily watch again. The whole drama of that, of all the screaming, I loved every scene that was about that.
And I was so happy that somebody gave Lee Pace a good part too.
I know. Yeah. I was so happy to see him.
And it reminded me of every scene with a sort of holdout or conscientious objector. It reminded me of The Messenger, when every scene with, like, a family had its own identity. Like, you didn't feel like you were just walking through a whole series of the same scene, which would have been really easy in that movie. And I thought similarly in Lincoln, like, every negotiation felt completely discreet and unique to itself, which was great.
I would watch a whole movie about Julie White and Hal Holbrook's little family drama.
Thank you.
Julie White shopping for her clothes.
Right?
About those as well.
Okay, so moving on to the other big release, Skyfall.
Skyfall.
Now, I know that Nick is not a big fan.
I'm not the biggest fan, although the martini I drank during was fantastic.
But the idea of missable, I really have to quibble with.
Quibble away.
Because I think, I'm not a Bond super fan or anything, but I tend to go see the movies. And I thought it was very much one of the stronger Bond films.
I'm not a Bond person kind of at all. I've seen maybe 3 Bond movies total in my life.
Mm-hmm.
When I saw Casino Royale, and that sort of had been greeted with similar sort of raves going up, where it was just like, oh my god, like, this is Bond, even if you don't like Bond movies, this is great, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And I saw it, and it wasn't bad, but I was a little deflated as to not, I felt like I wasn't seeing what everybody else was seeing.
Mm-hmm.
This one, I was completely satisfied by it on a movie level, and from the sounds of everybody in the theater who you could tell where the real Bond fans were, where they just sort of like would erupt into applause at things that I wasn't quite realizing why they were applauding.
So like the Aston Martin or something.
Well, that I knew, but yeah. Like, for fuck's sake, when that Aston Martin showed up, you would think it was like, I don't even know, like, just like people were falling out of their seats for that. but I knew why that was happening. But I just thought the cast was so strong.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the movie really, like, moved along. It kept that really good... I think Casino Royale got a little silly, where I feel like the sort of, like, silly Bond elements felt more part of the whole in Skyfall and didn't really ever take me out of it with being like, okay, well, like, this is stupid. What I'm watching right here is stupid. Even though, like, he legitimately, like, falls into the water at the beginning and then, like, into the liquid, like, opening credits Adele thing. But, like, which felt indulgent, but in a way that was like, look, like, you're making a Bond movie, you're allowed, like, an extra sort of 3 acres of space to work with that you're not really allowed with most movies, mm-hmm. where, like, you've got a lot of... There's, you know, people will forgive some indulgences, and I felt like that was...
People will applaud some indulgences.
Yes.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
Keep going.
Yeah. Well...
I don't know. I guess that's my point.
Yeah, and, well, I mean... As far as the cast, I was thinking to myself, I haven't quite done the research yet, but I did start looking at past directors of Bond movies, and I do think that they were, you know, sparing no expense into making the 23rd 50th anniversary feature a huge deal, because if you think about it, like, Bond films, even at the beginning, because they've been popular since, you know, the beginning, but they were always kind of, like... I don't want to say B movies, but not necessarily like prestige affairs, right?
Mm-hmm. Work for hires. And, yeah.
Right. But if you really think about this, it's top to bottom, like, and Oscar people.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And in a way that Bond never is.
Well, like, I think they got Sam Mendes on board, and Sam Mendes was like, I'm going to go bring the best of whoever I can. And then they had like 4 years to put it together. So.
Right.
If, like, they had the time to make it work or to pay everyone what they wanted, whichever.
Right. And, like, even things that wouldn't be as, like, vivid in a traditional Bond feature, like the scene between Ralph Fiennes and Judi Dench.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just, you know, that was just hugely impressive to me because I, like, that scene...
What scene?
The scene where he's basically threatening to fire her.
Oh, yeah.
And my favorite thing about that scene, which is early in the film, so it's not a big spoiler, is that they keep saying, forgive me, but... And I swear to God, every time they said forgive me, it was just like them saying fuck you to each other. That's how good the acting was.
Yeah.
The forgive me somehow sounded exactly like fuck you every time.
And I thought it played on the history of not only the franchise, but like the characters... In a way where I didn't have to see all the movies to understand that, like, there is sort of these deep relationships spanning eras of the movie and, you know, these sort of long-standing relationships with the fans of the franchise
mm-hmm.
that the movie was playing into, but it wasn't just being like, well, you had to be there. You had to be there at, you know, View to a Kill or something like that to get it. And it's just like, no. Like, Daniel Craig and Judi Dench are giving it to you all here.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of loved, like, the sort of parallels with the Bond, like, the Silva scene, you know, with the shirt unbuttoning, paralleling with the Bond scene with Bond and Eve. Like, I just thought it had a lot of, like, nice little touches. It was good, I thought.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what to make of people believing in its Oscar potential since Bond has, you know, all told, not won an Oscar since 1965, I believe.
Yeah,
even for songs?
I was going to say...
No, it doesn't win for songs either.
Wow. I feel like that's got... At least that has to change, right?
No, the last time Bond was even nominated for something was 1981.
But don't you feel like at the very least, Adele is going to be the exception to that?
Are we wagering on the music branch to do something?
Oh, God. I know. They are monsters. I have no idea what they're going to do.
They're monsters.
I think they should be the Bond villain in the next...
When you're talking about names like Roger Deakins, or when you're talking about Thomas Newman, I don't know whether they'll allow the score to be eligible, because it does weave in that classic Bond.
Well, as does
theme.
Adele's song.
Oh shit.
Oh,
well, then they're both
shame.
Doomed. They're both doomed then. Well, then what are we even talking
over.
About? But I do think Deakins has a shot of being nominated for this.
I do too. I mean, the Harry Potter movies got nominated for cinematography when they were really great. Like, I don't see any reason that shouldn't at least be considered.
But I think that when there are Roger Deakins complaints, right, they're about the fact that he obsesses over certain sequences and leaves other ones totally adrift. And I thought this movie really emblematized that problem with him. Like, there are entire half hours that were just, like, so indifferently shot and flat and people in weird parts of the frame. And then all of a sudden things would be incredibly beautiful and striking, like they increasingly get around the key set for the finale of the movie, and,
right.
and everything that's happening there is really true, gritty, and self-consciously kind of well shot. But there was so much kind of crap along the way, I thought, from his unit. I doubt it was even from him.
Do you think that makes it less nominatable, though, or do you think people will remember the good things and not obsess on the bad things so much?
They might. I mean, I always feel like cinematography is super, super crowded by the time we get to the end of the year, so I never know what's going to happen. But it made me kind of grumpy at him and at Sam Mendes, who I think is kind of a habitual, like, surround yourself. It's the same, it's similar to what you just said, but maybe more negatively spun about surrounding himself with people who cover up the fact that he's not a very good director and goes
I
for
like
this
Sam
really
Mendes
kind of.
Yeah, I like Sam Mendes a lot more than...
I tend to like Sam Mendes as well.
But I like that there's a variation of opinion about him, but it's true that I skew sort of low. Like, mm-hmm. American Beauty just feels like lightning in a bottle to me at this point. But I didn't like the Star Trek reboot either, and this felt very similar to me. But none of the, like, connecting dots with a previous franchise felt really resonant to me, and it seemed really not sure exactly how much to invest in some... of its characters, and the character that Naomi Harris is playing reminded me a lot of Eve reminded me a lot of Uhuru in the beginning of Star Trek, when like they make about 15 minutes of play of, we've got a totally new kick-ass version of her, are we set, okay, get behind a desk and shut up, like So she was the most striking example, but I thought Judi Dench's animosity toward Bond was so interesting in the last movie, and this just felt like a long setup for where her plotline inevitably goes.
See, I found that all fairly enthralling, everything to do with M and Bond and their relationship.
Say, I got to the end of the movie, the point where, you know, Bond and M kind of leave London and head up north, and I got to the point and I was like, wait, are we not over yet? Like, I feel like we had hit the end of the movie, and it was like this additional thing.
Casino Royale had that problem too.
Oh,
though.
Yeah, I mean, plenty of movies have this problem, but I really liked the time, I really liked getting the two of them out of there and putting them together and having them out in the field together. I really liked that element of their relationship, and like Joe, I really bought everything that happened between those two characters.
Mm-hmm. I love that you can sort of see her as the symbolic Bond girl this time.
Yeah.
Which, you know, because he's out to protect her and she's the one in distress. I mean, it was an interesting revision, I thought.
Yeah.
And especially even that they had that scene where he comes to her home. And just the way she reacts to the implication that he's in her home, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did the Christopher Nolan-ness of Javier Bardem's character take anybody out of the movie a little bit? That was probably the closest I got to feeling distracted.
Like, what makes him Christopher Nolan-esque?
Well, when he sort of, I think everything about him kind of invading the hearing, Parliament hearing with Judi Dench felt very, very, I'm not going to say ripped off, but like very similar to
it feels
a lot
like
of the Dark Knight.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't credit the character for that so much as, like, the way that it's set up and the way that it's, like, a city under siege. Mm-hmm. Like, I think the setup of the scene is Dark Knight-esque, but I don't know if Bardem's character, or if Silva is the cause of that.
Well, but it's sort of like, he has more of a personal stake in the story than the Joker does in The Dark Knight, but it's still mm-hmm. just sort of like, he takes that motivation, and then his cause after that is just sort of like tearing the whole thing down.
I just couldn't see the former MI6 recruit in him at all. Like, that storyline of who he was just didn't match this person that I was meeting enough for me to even go with it. It just seemed like a blur. Hmm. I am the bad guy, but nothing I was hearing about why he was the bad guy sort of made sense to me, I guess. Mm-hmm. Aren't you glad you invited me to the party? I'm here.
Well, I wrote my review will be up tomorrow, so none of you have read it yet. But I do go a lot into that scene and sort of the homoeroticism of it,
yeah,
and why I think Daniel Craig is like the essential reason that the new films work, like his whole persona. And anyway, but we could talk about that later, since.
Well,
or not at all, since you guys haven't read my review.
Well, but I also feel like...
You say that as if we had a choice. Like, right? Like, you told us
it's
to
not,
read it.
It's
I
not
feel
published.
Like I'm in
yeah.
trouble.
Yeah. If you had chased the breadcrumbs that Ben Wishaw had left of my secret review...
I will chase all
have...
the breadcrumbs that Ben Wishaw left. All of them.
You guys... He is so adorable, but every time I see him, and I curse Julie Taymor to this day.
Oh,
see,
God,
that's
he
why
takes
I,
out
I think,
Tempest? Oh, no.
All I think is he has no genitals.
That's why
oh,
I, will
no.
never, I will never see that movie. I will never, ever,
no,
ever,
don't
ever
do
see
it.
That movie.
But he is adorable. But that scene where, you know, they're joking about his age or whatever?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That scene bothers me because Ben Wishaw does not even remotely have a bad complexion.
I know.
No, I know. That was straining credibility.
Well, he's also like 32.
Right.
He just looks like he's 19.
Yeah, he looks super boyish. But yeah. People are really, really getting into this whole idea that he's this sort of stand-in for hipster culture because he's got glasses, I guess, is basically...
Yeah.
That Q is, not Ben Wishaw specifically, but...
That Q is, yeah. That's sort of like new Q because he's young and he's got glasses and whatever, and it's... It feels like trying to graft a narrative onto this that, like, there's a lot of narratives I feel like we can throw onto this movie, but maybe not that.
Yeah.
You guys are totally trying to trick me into being grumpy again, so I'm just keeping it tight.
Oh, man.
So, has everybody seen Holy Motors?
Nope.
Yes.
Yes.
You guys, I made the huge mistake of seeing it slightly drunk.
Oh,
very late at night.
That's a mistake?
No, it actually
that
turns
seems
out...
Like a great
idea. I know, that's what people say, but it actually turns out to be a huge mistake because I was having such trouble staying awake, and it was completely baffling to me. And not just in the way that it was meant to be.
Did you snore yourself awake like I did during Snow White and the Huntsman? Because that's really the worst thing you could possibly do.
Oh, Snow White and the Huntsman deserves it, though.
Yeah, it did.
But no, but the boyfriend was with me, and he did fall asleep almost instantaneously. And thankfully did not snore, though there were a few sounds emitted that I had to jab him.
Well,
to control.
You guys were able to sort of keep each other...
We kept it tight.
Honest. Yeah, he kept it tight. That's good.
I want to know what sounds he emits while he's sleeping that aren't snores. That sounds amazing.
He composes the Cloud Atlas sextet in his
If anybody would.
Let's just say the sounds emitted are as mysterious as Holy Motors itself.
Did he not even wake up for the accordion part? I feel like that would wake anyone up.
No.
Wow.
Actually.
You had said something about the accordion part, I think, in a tweet or something, mm-hmm. like a couple before I saw it, and so it was in the back of my mind that I was just so excited to see a kick-ass accordion part, and then it was so kick-ass and
I'm so
full
glad.
Of accordion.
I'm so glad great. It was not overhyped for you, because it is truly great.
Extra awesome anticipation. I loved. See how not grumpy I am anymore?
Love that. Accordions. That's all it takes.
I like the idea. I like putting together this vision of Holy Motors in my head from hearing other people talk about it, probably more than I will end up liking the movie. So I might put that off for a little bit.
The million-dollar question, how many massive Oscar nominations is Holy Motors going to get?
Oh my god. Well, so wait. Many best actor.
Is it English language?
It's,
no.
It's beyond language.
So,
yeah,
well,
right.
It emits sounds that may be able to language, but I'm not sure.
It's a foreign film in a different way than being a foreign language film. It's just foreign.
Yeah. Foreign from another planet, maybe.
Yeah. Can I just get quick yays or nays about Flight?
Oh, yeah.
Because we haven't talked about that, have we?
Oh, that's right. Okay, so we're not going to... Oh, fine.
We'll
have some flab on the podcast after all.
I resent that, but continue.
I give a moderate yay to leaning nay on Flight. I'm super in the middle about it, which is not that helpful to you. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's totally helpful to me because that's exactly where I am. Whatever.
Yay. Okay.
Joe.
Loved the crash scene. I was in a ball. I was in a knot when it was done. I was barely sitting on my seat when it was done.
Yeah.
But everything else, I really did not care for. I get why people are liking the Denzel performance, but to me, it's such sort of well-worn territory. Like, he's great. Like, he's good. Like, he's, you know, a very good actor. I don't know if anybody had heard. But... I found a lot of it to be, and maybe this was partly like the audience that I saw it in, and Katie, you're in the same audience as
mm-hmm.
me. But like when John Goodman comes in for his final scene where he sort of shows up at the hotel after like Denzel's at his like lowest low.
Very crowd pleasing moment.
It's so
movie.
Well, this is why I feel like if either one of the studios behind either Argo or Flight decides to, you know, put together a career achievement campaign for John Goodman, mm-hmm. I think he gets in because people
and
fucking
I will
love
puke.
Him. But that last scene in Flight was so reprehensible to me and probably felt that way because the audience was just like hooting and hollering
and loving it. And it's like morally horrendous and you
horrendous.
Can't...
Right, yeah. And that's like, and I'll deal with that scene if I'm allowed to feel that sort of horror in it. And instead I was sort of like being forced to feel this like revulsion at the audience that I was sitting in. Yeah, maybe that's not the movie's fault. But...
I think the movie has a problem with tone throughout.
Oh,
where, like,
it does,
well,
yeah.
It's mean, like, it, you know, bringing the Rolling Stones music cue, which is like jaunty, but you're like, no, this is not what this moment
yeah.
is.
Time yeah. for us all to apologize to Hope Springs, by the way, for saying that it was the worst, it had the worst music cues of any movie in 2012. that crown has been taken with gusto.
There's something about the expensiveness of the music cues in Flight that especially is galling. Like, how much money did they spend? Like, unbelievable amounts of money were spent on that movie's music rights.
I did feel like it was, I mean, I said this in my review, but I did feel like it was self-consciously naughty, which was somehow endearing to me, but also a problem for the movie. Like, that they kept sort of, like, pushing buttons on purpose.
Or, like, under the bridge while
I
Kelly Reilly
just
gets
about
by.
To
like,
say.
I couldn't...
Ugh.
I couldn't even start to deal with that.
I felt insulted by at that point. I was like, who... What network executive from hell, TV-wise? You know what I mean? Like, nobody would even do that on that level. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like a real world music cue. Remember how, like, I don't know when you all stopped watching The Real World, probably decades ago, but, like, their music cues are all, like, if someone's walking in the rain, they'll have a song titled Walking in the Rain by Demi Lovato. Flight sort of felt like that.
I mean, I did think it was several movies at once, but I was just so wowed by the Denzel movie.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I was really impressed by him as well. I'm with you on that.
That I give it a yay, even though I had a lot of problems with it. In order to keep the podcast tight, I had to do some editing here as we discussed Flight's many problems, including the epilogue and Melissa Leo.
The epilogue is rough, and like Zemeckis epilogues are usually things to stay away from anyway, right?
But, it's best to just walk out of the theater before the credits.
Totally. Like,
I would tell everyone, the minute Melissa Leo comes on screen in this movie, nothing to do with Melissa Leo, but just that's the time to leave.
Which was so great.
They
like waste all this time building up, like, when Ellen Block gets here, shit is going to rain from heaven, and then she's nothing. Like,
yeah.
She's just a total funk. She could have been played by Kim Greist. I mean, it just doesn't matter. But
wait, was Kim Greist in Lincoln?
Probably.
She played Lincoln.
That's why he couldn't see Daniel Day-Lewis.
Exactly, because it was Kim Greist. Yeah.
It was an I'm not there thing.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. This is the end. Hold your breath and count to 10. Feel the earth move and then.
No, I was going to say, Jodie Foster's 50th birthday.
Yes.
Is this week. So I want to hear very briefly as our extra. I'm really curious, actually, which is each of your single favorite performance by her. And I don't mean that you think it's the best, but favorite.
Okay, well, mine are the same anyway.
Okay.
I was playing this game with a friend of mine on Twitter where we're like, or on GChat, five favorite Jodie Foster performances. Fairly recently, in fact. We didn't even know it was her birthday, so we were sort of clairvoyant in that way. But I was sort of like looking at her IMDb list, because like I sort of feel like a Jodie Foster apologist at times, because I know opinion of her acting ability has sort of plummeted in the last decade. But like looking at her IMDb list, there's just not a lot that she works so much more sparingly than I thought. And there's a lot of sort of things you can't include on a top five list on her resume. Ultimately, like, it's a boring choice, but Silence of the Lambs means I will never not think that Jodie Foster's super, super fantastic. I'm glad that it's sort of the public pinnacle of her career and that she did win the Oscar for it, even though the competition that year was insane. And if they would have handed out 3 Oscars that year, I would have been fine. But that's the one I keep going back to. It's so, every time I see that movie again, I love her all the more.
I was going to say the same thing. I mean, for basically the same reasons, because like you go back to that and you're like, no, you are totally valuable. And like, it's kind of the starting point for anything else she does. Like, you have to be interested in whatever else she does, because she pulled that kind of thing off.
Yeah.
You know, she's got that in, because you know that character is in her. Like, it's not like it's some kind of one of those transformation pieces where, like, you know, Joaquin Phoenix, because he played Johnny Cash, will always be a great actor. Like,
right.
I totally agree. I watched Nell a lot. I don't know why, because I don't think it's such a great movie, but I watch it a lot. and I'll say that my favorite, like, unsung Jodie Foster performance and movie is The Dangerous Lives of Altar Boys.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a little tiny thing she did in 2002 with a brand new director who won one of the critics groups, like, New York, maybe even, for her first film for that movie, but it kind of went away. But yeah, I have it's Clarice all the way for me.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm the outlier here. I mean, I love her Clarice as well, but my favorite I actually think is Nell, and like I get why people don't, I get why it's a far more divisive performance, but I really appreciate how completely high wire it is in terms of it's. Like, she's putting herself out there to be... It's one of those performances that you can't be anything but risky, because even if you're perfect, people will reject it because it has such strange elements, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, the language and all that. I thought she was really special in it, and I think it's the most she ever pushed herself, actually.
Yeah.
Even though I think she's, you know... perfect in Silence of the Lambs. In terms of like a stretch as an actor, I just really respected Nell.
That's that she goes out of her way often in interviews to cite that as her favorite performance of her own for all the reasons you say. Like, that always impresses me when actors stick up for work that didn't get the same kind of reception.
It's always on, it's one of my favorite sort of what if scenarios about the Oscars where if Glenn Close wins in 1988, and so Jodie Foster only has one Oscar going into the 94 Oscars, whether she's more competitive in that category and there's more of a there's more of a groundswell for her.
If she still has two Oscars, but it's for Nell instead of The Accused.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Because, like, she's just, you know, she wasn't going to get a third Oscar, not for that. But, like, I don't know. That Jessica Lange Oscar, and maybe it's because I was so young at that Oscar, I was only in high school still. I don't know who was talking about Blue Sky at all. It just felt like a strange kind of default award to give to her. It felt like a strange Oscar. It still feels like a strange Oscar.
Well, Nick is our resident Jessica Lange expert.
Yeah, but I'm distracted right now because I'm realizing I wished we had this podcast then, because you would have asked us who else is nominated, who you'd like to switch roles. And I'm like, Nigel Hawthorne as Nell. And Martin Landau as Nell. I want to see a giant 20-person Nell off. Like, so I can't...
I'm not Nell.
I'm not Nell, yeah.
Yeah. So... For the first time in my life, I'm not thinking of Jessica Lange even in the back of my mind. Mostly I am. But.
Well, 94 is one of those years that the category was just so... The nominations were just so odd in general.
Right.
But I do think that, if I remember correctly, I could be remembering it incorrectly because I am a huge fan of Jodie as Nell. If I remember correctly, people did think she would have won had she not already had two Oscars.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Well, that's sort of like, I like playing that kind of like chain reaction game. My favorite of all of those is if Pacino wins in 74 for Godfather 2 instead of whatever Art Carney, then Denzel wins in.
I'm sorry. Did you say if Pacino wins in 75 for Dog Day Afternoon? Is that what you said?
That's what he meant to say.
Well, no, but I feel like that felt like the more, you know, winnable, he was in the best picture, whatever. I mean, for, you know, you could do any of them. This is my scenario, and I'll play it out as I like. No, but then Denzel wins in 92 for Malcolm X, and then...
And All is Right with the World.
Right, and then, but then who wins in 2001? Then Russell Crowe wins two in a row.
Can we just give it to Tom Wilkinson and just not... With the Russell Crowe thing.
Not with the Russell Crowe.
Except we know that wouldn't have happened, but yeah, that would have been lovely.
Paul Scofield as Nell.
Oh God. Oh, what a funny year 94 was for nominations, huh? Good gosh. Yes. Rosemary Harris.
As Nell.
As everyone. Rosemary Harris is Forrest Gump.
I remember Miranda Richardson was like very bitchy about her nomination that year, right? If I remember correctly.
I'm overdue.
Yeah.
Yeah, amazing.
Guys, Jennifer Tilly is Vincent Vega. Out. I'm out. That is everything. Let's do that. Let's just do like a time.
No, you guys, better yet. Better yet, Jennifer Tilly as Violet as Nell.
Yes. Perfect.
Okay. Oh, this was so fun.
Thank you, guys.
We're not even at an hour. We're fine.
Yeah. We're so keeping it so tight.
Yeah.
I want to thank Nick Davis.
The heart is Labinfany.
Katie Rich.
I got nothing. Just thank you.
If we all could imitate Jennifer Tilly as well as Nick Davis, we could all pick a line.
Kind of scary. Yeah.
And Joe Reed.
Let the sky fall.
And I'm Nathaniel. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.